You're listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology and Leadership.
Have you ever had a really tough knot that you needed to pull apart? Maybe it was the shoelace on one of your child's shoes, or maybe it was connected with a piece of jewelry, and it just took effort to untangle it and pull it apart. And you needed to do so carefully because you didn't want to break the jewelry, or you didn't want to break the nail on the knot in your child's shoelace. It can be tough to pull apart knots. Likewise with critical arguments, arguments that get formed in people's imaginations. They can be these knots that combine up both story and critical claims and evidence and all these things that get mashed together. And yet, it might be a knot or an argument that you don't agree with. It might be a knot that actually isn't helpful. It's in the middle of the lace rather than holding something together. Abortion can be one of those kinds of knots. Such a tough topic, bound up with people's personal experiences or others that they know, bound up with their ways of communicating and the character of the people making the arguments. Today's guest has tried to untangle popular pro-choice arguments. He's called it untangling because they can be these kinds of really difficult knots. Today's guest is Dr. Hendrik van der Breggen. Dr. van der Breggen is a philosopher. He taught philosophy at Providence College and University in Manitoba. He recently retired just in 2019. Dr. van der Breggen received his PhD in philosophy from the University of Waterloo, and he's the author of Untangling Popular Pro-Choice Arguments. You can find it on online booksellers. In today's episode, we're going to talk about some of these arguments. We're going to talk about consciousness, and we're going to talk about language. We're going to talk about what it means to have two men talking about this issue. We're going to offer some advice for people who are pastors and spiritual leaders and how they might go about addressing this issue. Now, I want to be clear. This is a tough topic. And in this episode, you're going to hear some frank language, not insensitive language, but frank language, because Dr. van der Breggen is a philosopher, and he goes at this topic to have clarity on the issues that are discussed. He tries to be as clear with his words as possible. In today's episode, you're going to hear about all those things, and I hope in a spirit that is winsome for you, the listener. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for a word from our sponsor, and then enjoy the podcast.
We are Wesley, and you belong here.
My name is Victoria Borum, and I am Wesley.
I'm Lenny Lucetti, and I am Wesley.
My name is Chris, and guess what? I am Wesley.
Hi, I'm Tina Shapit, and I am Wesley.
We recognize this beautiful diversity that the Lord has called together that is Wesley.
My name is Corey Merritt, and I am Wesley.
I am Wayne Brown, and I am Wesley.
I am Colleen Durr. And I belong here. You belong here too, because we are Wesley.
Welcome to the Wesley Seminary Podcast. Hendrik, it's great to have you.
Thank you for having me on, Aaron. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Untangling Popular Pro-Choice Arguments, Critical Thinking About Abortion. This is the book that you've just put out, where you've addressed several dozen questions and maybe ways of framing the issue of abortion in a kind of Q&A format. So you've taken a question or maybe a slogan or a statement and then provided some critical thinking to it. In this episode, I'd like to kind of try the same thing, present some questions to you and hear how you might respond or challenge us in ways that we would think about this really difficult topic. First one I'd like to start with is maybe you'd say start right at the very beginning. Why should we believe life begins when an egg is fertilized? Or why should we believe that life begins at conception?
That's a great question. And that's good to start at the beginning. Aaron, just before I begin, I just want to say again, thanks for having me on. I'm sure a big reason that I'm on your program is because your brother is my friend, Tim Perry. And I don't know much. I didn't know much about you, so I went and looked at your previous podcasts, and I have to say I quite enjoyed them. It was last Friday. I had kind of a podcast fest with Wesley Seminary, and I think I listened to five of them.
All right.
So those mostly the philosophy ones. One was C. Stephen Evans, and then Jerry Walls, and Robert George, and of course your brother Tim Perry, and then I also listened to Frederica Matthews Green, and I appreciated you're making an effort to make deep philosophical issues accessible to listeners. So thank you for that, and I hope that we can do that here too. Now to get to your question, why should we believe life begins when an egg is fertilized or at conception? And I would say that at fertilization or conception, something new begins. And so the question that arises is what is it? And we know that sperm life ends and then egg life ends at fertilization. So the object, when it comes to the sperm, the object whose function is to swim and fertilize and has a different genetic makeup comes to an end. And then with respect to the egg, the object whose function is to be penetrated by a sperm comes to an end as well. And so we have a new substance. It's neither egg nor sperm. It's different in terms of material or composition, and also in terms of behavior. It's a new substance, as I said, and it's a living, growing, self-governing, genetically distinct organism. And so we have to ask again, what is it? It's not canine or feline. It's human. It belongs to the human species. And also, it's a separate living entity. It's a human being. It's the first stage of human being. And then subsequent stages are the multicellular embryo, fetus or unborn child, infant or born child, toddler, adolescent, and then adult. And so that's the kind of reasoning that's behind why we should believe life begins when an egg is fertilized or at conception. And then just to add to that, as I put in the book, there was a global survey of biologists, and 95% of biologists agree with that. So it shouldn't be a question that is left unanswered. It looks like it does have an answer and a good answer. So the human being begins at conception.
Why do you think there is such a challenge to this way of framing things then? So you've marshaled some biological evidence and then some evidence from the survey data as well to make this argument that life begins at conception. In your own research, and you've interacted with people who are pro-choice and in congenial ways, right? Thoughtful and professional ways. In your experience, why do you think this is a sticking point for some people?
Well, I remember coming to this issue in the mid 80s, or perhaps 83-ish. In Canada, the law was being challenged concerning abortion, and in 1988, the law was struck down, so that abortion is allowed legally throughout the 9-month period of pregnancy. But I remember in the discussions back then that that many people would kind of intermingle or conflate moral questions with biological questions. And so they would say that they would see a human being as a moral category and try to justify abortion by just saying it's not a human being. And they weren't distinguishing the biological questions from the moral questions. And it seems to me that we need to ask the factual biological questions first, and then expand our moral, whether or not our moral principles apply to the answers that come there. So I think there was a conflation between the question, when does human life or human being begin, because of that conflation between biology and morality.
One of the things that you argue for in the book is that our language really matters.
Right.
So I was in a conversation one time with an acquaintance of mine. We were talking about this very issue and the subject of when life comes up, or sorry, when life begins was part of our discussion. And you see as the fertilized egg starts to multiply and cells are starting to form. And his response to me was that that's still simply a collection of cells or a lump of tissue. And in my mind, I thought, yes, that's true, but it's a failure of imagination, right? It's a failure of imagination just to say the word just. Yes, it is a collection of cells. I could look at my entire body and say it's just a collection of cells. It's a collection of cells. That's true. The falsity comes in whenever I say it's just. It's just that. And then I started thinking, that's a failure of imagination. I was thinking about how do I engage his imagination for him to see this as something different, or to recategorize it in a different way, even whenever we could agree on lots of our language, but the actual classification of what we were trying to talk about was different. In the book, you talk about that. Well, this is why language matters. So you,
right.
you example, rather than saying a fetus or an unborn human being about 8 weeks old, rather than saying a fetus is a potential human being, you say a fetus is a human being with potential. Where
Correct.
Else in this important conversation would you say that language matters? And you maybe would even talk about this rearranging you've made, rather than saying it's a potential human being to saying it's a human being with potential. Love to hear you talk about that. Love to hear you say where else you see language playing a key role in this discussion.
Yeah. Certainly, our use of language is important. We want language to describe reality accurately. And especially if we're talking about destroying or killing something, that's all the more reason or all the more important that we need to talk about whatever it is that we're talking about accurately. So when it comes to, say, the issue or the question of using language, potential human being versus human being with potential, the potential human being would be the sperm and the egg just before fusion. You have the potential of getting a human being, and then you have fusion at conception, and there you have a new life form, a new substance, and it turns out that that's the spatio-temporal genesis of a new human being, and it's a human being that has potential, human being with potential, to become its later stages. So that's an untangling that needs to be done. With regard to your question, where else in this conversation does language matter? I'd say pretty much everywhere else. For example, some people call, you know, as you mentioned, they call the embryo or fetus just a clump of cells or a cluster of cells. And yes, that's true. But as you mentioned, I too am a cluster of cells, a clump of cells. So what is it that's significant here or accurate? Like that's a very general term to say it's a cluster of cells. There's something more there than just a mere cluster of cells. My appendix is a cluster of cells. My liver is a cluster of cells, you know, and my, you know, the skin on my hand is a cluster of cells. So we need to look at it accurately to distinguish what kind of clusters are they, you know, like what are their inherent properties. And it turns out that the cluster of cells at conception and the fetus if we use language accurately, it's a human being that has the potential to become the subsequent stages. Other instances of where language use needs to be clarified. Sometimes the fetus is described as a parasite. I'm sure you've heard that, where that's a misuse of language. It's a parasite is an organism that belongs to a different species that ends up living off the host, whereas the fetus is not of a different species, and it's where it should be in the mother's womb. Sometimes we hear the phrase termination of pregnancy, and abortion is referred to as a termination of pregnancy, and that phrase is euphemistic. It hides the reality of what abortion is. Another instance of termination of pregnancy would be birth, and that's different from abortion, whereas abortion, the termination occurs by terminating, killing a life before it's born. Other terms, reproductive freedom is sometimes a phrase that's used to justify abortion. And the fact is that reproduction occurs when conception occurs. And so to justify abortion in terms of reproductive freedom is not a correct application of those words. You've been free to reproduce already. Now it's a question of, am I going to kill that which I've reproduced? And that's a different question. And certainly that's a hugely moral question if what you've produced is a human being, which it is. The phrase, every child a wanted child, is a phrase that was used by Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, who was a famous abortionist in Canada and still is. And he was influential in striking down Canada's abortion law. I remember seeing this online on his at his abortion clinic. He says, every child a wanted child. And we would say, yes, every child should be a wanted child. But heck, we don't kill the unwanted. And these words are used to basically hide the fact that if something or someone is unwanted, we have grounds to kill them because they're not wanted. And you think about, say, homeless people who are unwanted, you know, we don't have grounds to kill them because everyone should have a home, which is kind of a misuse of language again. Another phrase, if I can just go on, is a popular phrase that came up recently with the presumptive president-elect Joe Biden, and he said that abortion is essential health care. And I think here we need to be very careful with our language. First of all, it turns out that most abortions, like 95 to 98%, are not done for healthcare reasons, let alone essential healthcare reasons. They're done for socioeconomic reasons and pressures of that nature. Also, there are, I point this out in my book, there are doctors who are saying that there is no place for an abortion for healthcare. They just don't do it. If you abort, I mean, there are ectopic pregnancies and the deaths of, say, fetuses due to, say, a treatment for cancer. But that's not an abortion per se. That's just not an abortion, according to these doctors. So that throws some light into this claim that abortion is essential health care. And I would even drill further philosophically. Essential healthcare, like when we think of, like I have one of my daughters-in-law is pregnant with one of our grandchildren, and she goes to have prenatal checkups, and essential healthcare would be the doctor looking at my daughter-in-law and her child, and so that would be essential healthcare. So you have two patients there. But if we consider abortion essential health care, then it throws a kind of a contradiction in this whole notion of essential health care. So on the one hand, you look after two patients, and on the other hand, you kill one of the patients. So that's a problem with that notion of essential health care. And I would even drill deeper, and this further philosophical drilling, I have to acknowledge a recent friend of mine, Nathan Apodaca, who is an associate with the Life Training Institute, and he wrote a real fine article where I'm getting this from, and the title of the article escapes me at the moment. But he goes on to say, you know, if we do use the phrase essential health care, then it looks as if we're saying that something is wrong when a woman is pregnant. And this is to say that, you know, like think of eyesight. Healthcare for eyesight is to ensure that your eyes are functioning properly so you can see, right? And so healthcare in the case of, say, pregnancy would be to ensure that the pregnancy goes well. And so if we say that abortion is essential healthcare, we're saying that women, when they're pregnant, are unhealthy. And that just is really odd. And I think we could say that by saying abortion is essential health care, we're actually implying that somehow women are less than men because they can get pregnant. And that strikes me as a terribly sexist claim that's implied by the phrase abortion is essential health care. So that's quite a long answer to that question about abortion being essential healthcare, but I think we need to think about these things so that our words describe reality accurately, and that we don't turn caring into killing, which is just outrageous morally.
There are two things that I want to use. We'll start with one, then we'll go to the other one in a little bit later in the episode. Okay. The first one is that you've given us some arguments so far, whether arguments against being pro-choice or at least limiting or correcting the language that we use that's often used in conjunction with being pro-choice. And you haven't used scripture reference, right? You've talked about drilling into our language and using it carefully. In the book, you're not arguing for against pro-choice arguments using scripture. You're arguing it as a philosopher, because that's your training, that's been your profession. You are a philosopher, and you're attempting to use language as clearly and carefully and precisely as possible. Now, with that in mind, here's the first thing. I'd like to access the philosopher in you a little bit. There might be a distinction that some people would make sometimes between, okay, that's a human being, not a person. All right. So there's a distinction being drawn between what's a human being. I mean, they would say, sure, a fetus at 8 weeks is a human being, not yet a person, because they're saying there's certain faculties or abilities that go into being a person. What role would you say that consciousness plays in personhood and human being? Because obviously the fetus at 8 weeks isn't conscious, right? There's not a level of self-awareness that they would be able to articulate themselves as a person. That might be true for others, not simply unborn children either, right? There might be different people and different states of being where we might not be conscious. I mean, you know, when I'm asleep, I'm not often conscious either. Maybe I'm dreaming, but most likely I'm not. So I'd love to hear you as a philosopher address that distinction between human being and person, and maybe work in the category then of consciousness to help us get some clear thinking on this connection of the unborn child being a human being or maybe a person.
A person, right. Yeah, the question of consciousness looms large in a lot of the abortion choice philosophical work. People who argue that the fetus or embryo are not conscious, and so they are game for they're not persons, and therefore it's not a problem to abort them or kill them. So they see. So these philosophers or ethicists, many who support abortion choice, would see consciousness as a necessary condition for personhood. That is to say, to be a person, a being with the right to life, requires consciousness. And consciousness would be understood as exercisable capacity to be self-aware, have desires, have plans for the future, have what is sometimes called a biographical life as opposed to a merely biological life. But problems. So that's the claim, and some would point to the fact that the brain of the fetus hasn't been developed yet, and it's not in the embryo. But there are problems that arise, and these problems show that what matters is not consciousness per se, but the capacity to give rise to consciousness. So this is what you have when you're sleeping, and this is what stunned people have, say, when they get hit in the head, and this is what people in reversible comas have, too, the capacity to give rise to consciousness. And this is what the fetus has, too, the capacity to give rise to consciousness. Now, it helps to make a distinction between a fundamental capacity for consciousness and an immediate exercisable capacity for consciousness. Adults have the latter, that is to say, adults have the immediate exercisable capacity for consciousness because, you're right there and you can be conscious. The fetus has the former, this fundamental capacity for consciousness, and this is what the sleeping and the stunned and the people in reversible comas have too. So, contrary to what an abortion choice advocate would think, consciousness, which is the immediately exercisable consciousness, is not a necessary condition for personhood. It's merely a sufficient condition. So if you have consciousness, yes, that's enough to show that you're a person, but it's not required to show that you're a person. What is required is the inherent capacity to give rise to consciousness, which is what, again, sleeping, stunned persons in a reversible coma have. And that is what the fetus has. And this also allows us to get through, if you're sleeping, on the one hand, you're supposedly you cease to be a person. And then when you wake up, you're a person again. This inherent capacity to give rise to consciousness is something that allows us to have a continuation through that passage where you're not conscious. And this continuation, this inherent capacity to give rise to consciousness, is what the fetus has. And it would be like having somebody in a reversible coma who's been in a coma, say, all their lives, and then we know that in 9 months they're going to wake up and exercise their capacities for consciousness. And we would say, we shouldn't kill them. And ditto for the fetus. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. What it makes me think about is this, to go back to the language of the fetus is a human being with potential, not a potential
right.
human being. They're a human being with potential for consciousness. And the only thing keeping them from that is a certain amount of development, which
right.
barring either unforeseen or external factors is going to happen. So it's a matter of time before they become a being who is conscious, self-aware, able to desire, make plans, and so on.
Yeah.
And as such, it's not a qualitative difference between the unborn child and the 39-year-old male, right?
Right.
What I am in this moment. The only thing that's different in with this in mind is time. And
yeah.
you know, there's other differences, but within pretty small margins, right? There's a lot of similarity. The potential will grow into actuality without
right.
Without it being artificially inhibited and
right.
stopped.
And I would say that the actual capacity is there, right? The capacity, it just needs to unfold or blossom,
yeah.
and without us interfering by killing it. So, and just as a similar, some people would point to end of life situations where, say, a person is dying and they become unconscious and their brain stops functioning, and they say, well, hey, why don't we, you know, use that? We think it's okay to say, you know, pull the plugs or whatever. So why don't we use that as a way of understanding what happens at the beginning of life? And they kind of use a mirror image. But I think the use of the mirror image is a faulty analogy, because at the end of life, if we had the case of the fetus, the unborn child, if we just wait and do nothing, the brain will start to come back, right? It starts to become active. It becomes conscious. Whereas at the end of life, the brain ceases to exist. So it's one thing to have the cessation of brain activity, which you have at the end of life, which is different from the mere absence of brain activity, say, at the beginning, because the absence just is basically a question of maturation or immaturity, not maturation. We just need to wait and let it grow.
One of the aspects of thinking about this philosophically is mm-hmm. there's a use of terminology that can be bracing, right? So a number of times you've used the word killing rather than a softer version that maybe you would
right.
say. And part of this is the way you've tried to go about this is, how do we use accurate language, even if it's frank language? How do I use that? Now, this is the second thing I was wanted to talk about, but I want to break it into two aspects. One of the things we might be keenly aware of, especially in a 21st century postmodern West, is that the language we use is bound up with our forms of life. And so somebody might be listening to this episode and they're tracking, right? They're following the argumentation, they're following the distinctions that you're making between the capacity to give rise to consciousness, or the as a fundamental capacity, or as an immediate capacity, right? They're tracking these things, and yet they're still saying, well, Hendrik, your willingness or ability to use the word killing itself is already maybe a bit of a problem, right? They would say, and then they'd look at me and they'd say, well, we've got two men that are discussing the issue of abortion.
right.
Why is it something that men might consider? And there's a place for that kind of reflection that I want to go to in the next question. But I'd like for you to, in maybe a bit more personal way, but I'd like you to keep reflecting on this as a philosopher for us. Why is it something that, why is this a subject that two men might consider, since men can't become pregnant?
Yeah, that's a good question. It might be just helpful to back up a little bit and untangle a popular pro-choice argument that's related to this question. Leaders debate in Canada, well, recent, it was a year ago, in October of 2019, one of the leaders, Jagmeet Singh, who's with the New Democratic Party, and he's the leader, and the abortion issue came up, and basically he said, men don't have a right to talk about abortion. And the argument is this: you're a man, therefore your arguments about abortion don't count. Now, I would say that there are a couple of problems with that kind of argument. The first problem is that it's an ad hominem. That's the fallacy in which a person is attacked as opposed to his or her arguments. The messenger is attacked rather than the message. And I would add that arguments don't have a sex. They basically stand or fall on their own merits. And when it comes to argument assessment, we want to look at the premises. Are they true, reasonable to believe to be true? And then how do they relate to the conclusion? Like, is it a relationship of deductive validity? Is it some kind of inductive support? So we basically, I used to use this acronym with my students, ARG. Are the premises acceptable? A, are they relevant? R, and do they provide good grounds? G, and so that would be the tool that we use to assess arguments. And to basically dismiss what someone's argument is because they are of a particular sex is to violate the R, the relevancy criterion. So it's an ad hominem. It'd be like, my doctor is a woman, and it would be like dismissing what my doctor says about prostate cancer, which is something that only men have, and saying, well, she's a woman, so I don't have to believe what she has to say. And I think the proper response would be, well, that would be an ad hominem, a fallacy. She may have good arguments, good reasons for thinking that I have, you know, that we have concerns about men's prostates. So that's one. It's an ad hominem. And then two, if a man says that, and in the case of that leadership debate, a man did say that, there would be some self-refutation going on. It's like a man says men's arguments about abortion don't count. Well, that when we use language, there's a field of reference that occurs to which our language is referring. So if I say, like, all cats are furry, you know, the field of reference is cats, right, and their fur. And if I say, you know, every sentence in English has more than or less than three words, it includes all sentences, which is including that sentence, which basically is false because it has more than three words if we count them. And so here we have a man saying that, you know, all men's arguments about abortion don't count. And so if that's true, then we shouldn't buy into his argument because he's a man, which is to say we can dismiss it. So I think it's an ad hominem, and if said by a man, it's self-refuting. Yes, men cannot get pregnant, and I would acknowledge that. But when we're talking about the abortion issue, I think we men, along with women, can talk about things like, when does life begin? What is destroyed in abortion? What are human rights? What is a person? Those kinds of questions arise. And then we can also talk about how can we help pregnant mothers and their children. And I don't think those are to be relegated to a particular arguer's sex.
I think
does that make sense?
It does. I think that if I was to look at a series of claims leading toward a conclusion, claims mm-hmm. and their defenses leading towards a conclusion, and it was simply written on a piece of paper, that would be relevant to me to consider on its own merit without knowing who the author was. Now, the author of it will make me want to maybe analyze the claims a little bit differently, right? Maybe what... All that goes into the, not everybody's an analytic philosopher. So their claims or their words might have more or less meaning depending on who they are and what might be bound up into them. So the identity of the person making the argument, I would say, has a measure of relevance, but I can still analyze the relevance of claims without knowledge to who the person making the claims is. It might rise or fall without that additional information. Now, what I can do with the knowledge of who is making the claims is hold people accountable to those claims, right? If a person makes an argument to come to a conclusion, I can tease out implications and bring back to them and say, well, how are you living according to these? And that's actually one of the arguments that you make in the book and really nicely named, because I think that people who are pro-choice and look at people who are claimed to be pro-life, but don't have any element of their actual practical life that reflects right. that, are naming something that we all kind of know in our gut really matters, even if it doesn't matter to the actual argument being made. And one of the things, you know, it's why it's so important if people are going to engage in this argument, and they should, if it's part of what they believe to be true and have reasoned through, is to mm-hmm. make sure that their own life is lining up as best they can and within reason, and within the possibilities given to them, is make sure their own life is lining up with the implications of the arguments that they are making. And right. You tease out some of these aren't analytical arguments, but they are existential ones, right? Like, back it up, mister, right? Like, you've done a nice job of presenting different evidence that people who are pro-life are doing things that still match up with what their argument argument makes.
Yeah, I think the charge would be, you know, you're a hypocrite if, you know, you say this one thing, but you're doing another. And I think, strictly speaking, you know, a hypocrite can make good arguments, but it's just that we have trouble taking them seriously because of the life of the hypocrite, right? And so there's two things going on there. One, we have to assess the argument. They could be good, right? Even though the person is a hypocrite, you know, like for example, I could be, you know, I could make an argument for saying that, you know, I think it's wrong to tear limbs off of kittens just to see them scream, right? And it might be true that I don't volunteer at my local animal shelter, but I think we could still say, okay, he should volunteer at his animal shelter, but at the same time, his argument that we shouldn't rip paws off of kittens or whatever, or legs off of kittens for fun, is still a good argument, right? And I think it would just have more impact or more believability or credibility if I do work at the animal shelter. And just for the sake of a footnote, we have a cat who was sitting on my lap named Rupert, and we got him from the animal shelter. I would never dream of tearing his paws off of him, just for the sake of the record.
Well, that's actually my next question, so I'll just brush that one off. Yeah, okay. Really clear the limbs off kittens? All right, let me move into my last question. And this is kind of the outflow then of it, the relational impetus and importance.
Right.
You've been discussing this. We've been talking about this, trying to use clear language, frank language, not insensitively, but with an intentionality for clarity and using words in precise ways. I'd like to close our conversation by asking for some personal reflections from you on the nature of these conversations, because this book didn't emerge in a vacuum from you. It emerged over conversations and both in print and then in person as well. You've had these conversations before. What advice do you have for pastors and spiritual leaders who are in conversations about this really sensitive topic?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I think it really boils down to speaking truth in love, and we need to show lots of grace, lots of mercy, show lots of kindness, and then show respect to those with whom we disagree, and do this because we have to remind ourselves that God loves all of us. He loves those with whom we disagree, so we need to love, be gracious, merciful, kind, and yet also hold on to the truth. And there's a certain art to that, and a certain, I think, the art of being a person is knowing when to speak truth and do so with discretion and love and kindness. And there are other things going on in a person's lives, and probably they don't want to hear some of the interesting philosophical stuff that we've been talking about. And if somebody's struggling with you know, contemplating having an abortion, but at the same time, we need to speak truth in love. And I would say, so that would be my first thing that I would encourage pastors and spiritual leaders to couple love and truth together and have wisdom in speaking truth. But also I would encourage the doing of homework, study. Sadly, I've become aware of pastors and leaders and even Christian professors who actually don't believe the unborn are persons and don't believe that the unborn are human beings. And I've seen this firsthand, and it brought dismay to my heart. And I saw too that their reasoning was shoddy. They basically were entangled by the various popular pro-choice arguments that we've been talking about, and which I have untangled or attempt to untangle in my book. And those kinds of arguments, I think, are an affront to careful reasoning and discernment of what's true. So I would encourage pastors and spiritual leaders, especially Christian pastors, spiritual leaders, to consider taking time to study this issue, and then also even taking time to study logic and argument. It seems to me that Christian emphasis on Christian pastors and spiritual leaders are supposed to be ambassadors or representatives of Jesus, right? And then I think back to John 1:1 in the New Testament, and where Jesus is described as the Word, the Logos, become flesh. And as a philosopher, I was interested in that because the Greek word Logos has to do with reason and moral value, and historically, philosophically, the Logos was understood to be something that permeates and structures the universe. And then with the Christian revelation in Jesus, we see that it's also that, it's that, and it's also personal, as the person Jesus, the man, the God-man, reveals. So I think Christian pastors and spiritual leaders, they need to reason better. I think we honor God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, who works in us when we think and reason in such a way that truth is discerned, and then truth is also communicated in love. So my advice is to Christian pastors and spiritual leaders, speak truth in love and use our God-given faculty for thinking at the same time. And then through the power of the Holy Spirit, we can demolish arguments that set themselves up against the knowledge of the Logos, of the Christ. And thereby we can demolish anti-truth, anti-Logos, anti-Christ argumentation. And I think it's important because truth is important, and also lives depend on this. So, and maybe just a final thought, I would encourage pastors and Christian leaders to add some good books to their church library, and not only their church library, but also their local public libraries and their high school libraries, and then also make an effort to support their local Christian resource or pregnancy resource centers, where we can actually help women who are contemplating abortion and see abortion as their only choice, when I think we can provide help. So
I know that one of the two rules that I found so helpful was to imagine the person that I'm speaking with. And this is a bit challenging, but even more important in the act of preaching, is that to imagine that there is a person who is wrestling with the very subject that we're talking about,
yeah,
or has wrestled with it and come to a different conclusion at some point in their past, even if today they're reconsidering what their position is on the issue. And if I keep actual flesh and blood people in mind, then
right,
far less tempting for me to try and score some rhetorical points than it
yeah,
is to
yeah,
the soul of a person. And this, and many times it's not what is said, it's the way in which it's said. And
that is the
putting together of truth and love, right? The truth is staying the same, but the attitude of love is going to completely change, even just like the pace and the force and the demeanor in which it's all said. And that was one of the things I appreciated about your book, Hendrick, Untangling Pro-Choice Arguments, is that it's not a book out to score rhetorical points. It's having conversation, and it's been entrusted to people who have asked these questions and who have disagreed with you. So it's got a real personal flavor.
Yeah. Yeah. I had an experience once with a friend who lost their child, and I basically just sat with him and wept and was quiet. And later, I don't know, it was weeks or months later, he said, you know, thanks for not saying anything. And I think sometimes speaking truth in love means sometimes you have to just shut up, right? But also we have to speak truth in love. And so sometimes, as I mentioned, that this is the art of discernment, is when to do that properly and wisely and gently and respectfully, lovingly. So.
Joining us today has been Dr. Hendrik Vanderbreggen. Dr. Vanderbreggen is the author of Untangling Popular Pro-Choice Arguments, Critical Thinking About Abortion. It's available on Amazon.com and other online booksellers. Untangling Popular Choice Arguments, Critical Thinking About Abortion. Hendrik, thanks so much for taking the time to discuss this really difficult but important topic with us today.
Thank you, Aaron. It was my pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you've made it through this difficult episode, then I commend you, and I trust it's been one that has will prove fruitful in your own ministry. Of course, here at the Wesley Seminary Podcast, we aim to introduce topics and resources for fruitful ministry. I believe Untangling Popular Pro-Choice Arguments is one of those resources. Thanks, Cam, for your production work, editing, and making this podcast episode available. Thanks again, Dr. Vanderbreggen. Appreciate you taking the time. Thanks again, listeners. And trust you all to have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.